and without an inhabitant as it is this day. Because you have burned incense, and because you have sinned against the Lord, and have not obeyed the voice of the Lord, or walked in His law, in His statutes, or in His testimonies, therefore this calamity has happened to you as it is this day. Moreover, Jeremiah said to all the people and to all the women, Hear the word of the Lord, all Judah, who are in the land of Egypt. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, saying, You and your wives have spoken with your mouths and fulfilled with your hands, saying, We will surely perform our vows that we have made to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven and pour out drink offerings to her. You will surely fulfill your vows and perform your vows. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, all Judah who dwell in the land of Egypt. Behold, I have sworn by my great name, says the Lord, that my name shall no more be named in the mouth of any man of Judah in all the land of Egypt, saying, Jehovah God lives. Behold, I will watch over them for adversity and not for good. And all the men of Judah who are in the land of Egypt shall be consumed by the sword and by famine until there is an end to them. Yet a small number who escape the sword shall return from the land of Egypt to the land of Judah. And all the remnant of Judah who have gone to the land of Egypt to sojourn there shall know those words will stand, whose words will stand, mine or theirs. And this shall be a sign to you, says the Lord, that I will punish you in this place, that you may know that my words will surely stand against you for adversity. Thus says the Lord God, Behold, I will give Pharaoh Hophra, king of Egypt, into the hand of his enemies, and into the hand of those who seek his life, as I gave Zedekiah, king of Judah, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, his enemy, who sought his life. That's technically the end of the historical section. Chapter 45 is very short, five verses long, and it's a promise made to Baruch. Baruch had been Jeremiah's faithful scribe. He had risked his liberty and so forth. He had had to hide with Jeremiah from Zedekiah the king. He had been faithful to Jeremiah, and he was taken captive with Jeremiah down into Egypt. And while all these terrible calamities were said to come on the people of Judah and Egypt, Baruch, who was one of them, was given a special assurance that it would not happen to him. Just like Ebed-Melech, the Ethiopian eunuch who had championed the cause of Jeremiah, was given special immunity by a promise from God, so is Baruch given here in these few verses. The word that Jeremiah the prophet spoke to Baruch, the son of Neriah, when he had written these words in a book, at the instruction of Jeremiah in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying, Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, to you, O Baruch, you said, Woe is me now, for the Lord has added grief to my sorrow. I fainted in my sighing, and I find no rest. Thus you shall say to him, Thus says the Lord, Behold, what I have built I will break down, and what I have planted I will pluck up, that is, this whole land. And do you seek great things for yourself? Baruch, do not seek them. For behold, I will bring adversity on all flesh, says the Lord, but I will give you your life to you as a prize in all places wherever you go. So, Baruch, for his faithfulness, he's a lesser known character in the story of Jeremiah, but he's always Jeremiah's faithful servant and scribe. He is given a reward with the faithful. You know, I said that we would cover the remaining chapters, the burdens against the nations, in our next session. I didn't realize we'd have as much time as we do at the end of this session. I knew it would go quickly because it was mostly history and narration, didn't need much comment, but I think what we'll do is just kind of survey these chapters. I have asked you at the beginning of our studies in Jeremiah to read 10 chapters ahead every day. If you did that, you've already read these long ago. The thing about these burdens of the nations is that they're all kind of alike. In a way. Not only like... There's a burden against Egypt in chapter 46. Then chapter 47 is a burden against the Philistines. And then chapter 48 is a burden against Moab. It's a long one. And then chapter 49 is against Ammon, the brother nation to Moab. Remember, Ammon and Moab were both descended from the sons of Lot. And then, further, in chapter 49, at verse 7, there's a burden against Edom. And in verse 23, against Damascus, which was the capital of Syria. So really, it's a burden against Syria. And in verse 28, against Kedar and Hazor. an Arabian tribe, and the Elamites in verse 34. And then chapters 50 and 51 are against Babylon itself. Now, you'll find that these resemble very much the corresponding chapters in the book of Isaiah and in Ezekiel. In Isaiah, the chapters are chapters 13 through 23, I believe it is. 11 chapters. And many of the same nations are addressed in Isaiah. Ezekiel also has a section of chapters like that. Off the top of my head, I don't remember. I think they start at chapter 32 of Ezekiel. No, earlier than that. Yeah, considerably earlier. They start in chapter 25 of Ezekiel. And in Ezekiel 25, you have the burden against Ammon, then against Moab, then against Edom, against the Philistines, then against Tyre and Sidon in chapters 26 through 28 of Ezekiel. Chapter 29 against Egypt, which is what we have in Jeremiah 46. Ezekiel has a burden against Egypt in Ezekiel 29 and 30 and 31 and 32. Four chapters against Egypt in Ezekiel. But see, all of the major prophets, well, I should just say Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, because Daniel doesn't have anything like this in it. But the major prophets do have these blocks of chapters that are unlike the majority of their material. Most of their material is addressed to their own nation about calamity, but none of them had a ministry that was restricted just to their own people. They also had warnings of disaster against the nations. It's possible that these warnings were actually spoken in the ears of the kings of those nations, that they actually traveled to some of these places. It's more likely that they just stood in Israel and spoke in the hearing of the Israelites these burdens against these nations, more as an encouragement to the Israelites. The last we read in the chapters of Jeremiah that we've covered was that God was going to bring judgment on the Jews who had gone into Egypt. The reason for that is because Egypt itself was going to be conquered by Babylon, and chapter 46 tells of it. I honestly don't see it as necessary or helpful to read these things verse by verse, just because it is so repetitious. I mean, these burdens against the nations tend to be very repetitious. Hopefully you've read them. They do not necessarily all come from the end of Jeremiah's ministry. They're just grouped at the end of the book because they haven't been mentioned earlier. For instance, the prophecy against Egypt is not even against Pharaoh Hophra. Pharaoh Hophra was the Pharaoh that in chapter 44 we read was going to be given to Nebuchadnezzar. But here, the judgment in chapter 46 verse 2 is concerning Pharaoh Necho, the king who killed Josiah. And that he was going to be defeated at the battle of Carchemish. And so that's what this is about. And you can see very typical of the prophets predicting war, punishment, judgment. They describe the battle. They just have a lot of doom and gloom. He says specifically in verses 13 and following that it will be Babylon. Verse 13 says, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, will do this to them. But in verses 27 and 28, we have, as is often the case, a reprieve for God's people. It says, but do not fear, O my servant Jacob, and do not be dismayed, O Israel, for behold, I will save you from afar, and your offspring from the land of their captivity. Jacob shall return and have rest, and be at ease. No one shall make him afraid. Do not fear, O Jacob, my servant, thus says the Lord, for I am with you. For I will make a complete end of all the nations to which I have driven you, but I will not make a complete end of you. I will rightly correct you, for I will not leave you wholly unpunished. So here he is again saying that even though Egypt is going to fall, yet the remnant of Israel will return from Babylon someday. We've read already prophecies along those lines. Prophecy against the Philistines. This prophecy against Philistia, we're told in verse 1, was uttered before Pharaoh attacked Gaza. Gaza was a Philistine city. And so, in all likelihood, this has nothing to do with the Babylonians conquering the Philistines, but an earlier event where the Egyptians attacked the Philistines. And it's a short prophecy of only about 6 verses, and it talks about judgment coming on the Philistines and destruction. Chapter 48, a long chapter, is entirely about Moab. Verse 4 says, Moab is destroyed, her little ones have caused a cry to be heard, and so forth. One of the interesting passages in this chapter, verse 11 through 12, this is of all these chapters about the burdens, this is one of the most interesting statements. It says in verse 11, Moab has been at ease from his youth. He has settled on his dregs and has not been emptied from vessel to vessel, nor has he gone into captivity. Therefore, his taste remained in him and his sense has not changed. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I shall send him wine workers who will tip him over and empty his vessels and break the bottles. Then Moab shall be ashamed of Chemosh, the national god of Moab, as the house of Israel was ashamed of Bethel, their confidence. Bethel's where the golden calf was that Jeroboam set up. Now, verses 11 and 12 are interesting because Moab is compared with a bottle of wine, and reference is made to the ancient custom known at the time of making wine. They would put the newly tread grape juice into a bottle of sorts, and then they wait for the dregs to settle on the bottom. When they would trample the grapes and then put all the liquid into a bottle, there were things like the pits of the grapes and skins and so forth that if they are allowed to stay in there, they kind of give a foul taste to the wine. But it's not easy to strain them off, so they just wait for them to settle to the bottom. They're heavier than the wine is, or than the juice is, and so the dregs would settle to the bottom. And then usually they'd pour the wine off into another bottle, being careful not to get much of the dregs in. They'd kind of pour off most of the wine off the top and leave the dregs in the bottom. But there'd still be some dregs in it. They'd let it settle some more. The new container would also contain it for a while, and the dregs that were left in it would settle there, and they'd pour it off again into another, trying to leave the dregs in the earlier container. And after they'd pour it back and forth several times, they managed to get essentially all the dregs out, and they had wine that was pure enough, or grape juice that was pure enough to make into wine. If they did not pour the wine from container to container, if they allowed the dregs to remain in it too long, it would give a bad taste to the wine. It would not allow the wine to develop its sweet flavor.
They still do that.
And they still do it the same way?
Well, the last one with the bottle, they do it with when they have the bottle.
Mm. That's the way I make it, Steve.
When Steve makes wine, he does that way too, yeah.
In the dining room, when they serve it, they'll pour it in a glass, let it sit. Or pour it in a separate bottle. Mm. They'll let it sit for like 10 minutes and then pour it.
Being careful of the bottle. Interesting. Yeah, so I know this is still practiced to some degree. Now, Moab is compared with a bottle of wine that has never been poured from vessel to vessel. The dregs have been allowed to remain in it, and it's caused them to be foul, as far as God is concerned. Now, that's what he says in verse 11. Moab has been at ease from his youth. He has settled on his dregs. He has not been emptied from vessel to vessel. Nor has he gone into captivity. Therefore, his taste remained in him, and his scent has not changed. What this means is, God has permitted Moab to worship Chemosh, and has never really poured them out of their vessel, made them go into captivity, in other words. If they had, perhaps they would have repented. Perhaps they would have turned from Chemosh. Perhaps the dregs that offend God in their society would have been done. But they've actually been left unmolested. They've been at ease too long. And therefore, they've gotten, you know, secure in their worship of their false god. And he says, therefore, I'm going to do them a favor. I'm going to come and bring some wine workers who are going to tip over the bottles. In verse 12. They're going to empty his vessels and break the bottles. They're going to be scattered from their land. And then they'll be ashamed of Chemosh. The thing that I find interesting about this is that it suggests that going into captivity or being changed from bottle to bottle is beneficial for the life of a nation. That if it is too secure and too prosperous for too long, it tends to become complacent, spiritually speaking. Israel went into captivity in 722. Later, Judah went into captivity. And these were things that God did to purge them of the idolatry that had come in them. Moab had never gone into captivity. Therefore, idolatry was pretty well established there. And people were content with it that way. They had no reason to question the validity of their worship. They had no reason to consider worshiping Jehovah instead. And therefore he said, I'm going to pour them out. I'm going to take them into captivity. In verse 26, using the same image of wine, says, make him drunk. Moab, that is. Verse 26, make him drunk, for he magnified himself against the Lord. Moab shall wallow in his vomit, and he shall also die in derision, be in derision. This is reminiscent of the passage in Jeremiah 25, where Jeremiah was told to take the wine cup to all these nations, including Moab, and make them drink it. And this wine was the wine of God's wrath and a sword that was coming against them. I might just mention as a point of what I find humorous in verse 40. It says, behold, one shall fly like an eagle and spread his wings over Moab. There's always certain people looking for modern-day fulfillments of prophecy. And things like, where is it? In Nahum. In Nahum it talks about the chariots jostling in the streets. Do you remember that? I've seen tracts written before to try to show all the modern fulfillments of prophecy, and they've tried to say that Nahum was speaking about modern freeways with the cars crowding the freeways and so forth, the chariots jostling each other, when really Nahum's just talking about the Babylonian chariots coming into Nineveh and destroying them. I mean, it's like the war chariots are coming in and they're running through the streets of the invaded city. But people often who don't know what the Bible's talking about and don't do any homework and don't really care to bother themselves to find out what it's talking about, often will take what something looks like on the surface and try to make some kind of modern fulfillment. I heard that I think it was in World War II, that, I don't remember very much about it, some kind of air raid over the land that was once Moab was a significant factor in the determination of the war. I don't remember the details. I'm sorry, I don't read this kind of literature very often. But I remember someone quoting this verse, behold, one shall fly like an eagle and spread his wings over Moab. The idea being that someone found some modern fulfillment in that in an Air Force raid that was over the land that had been Moab. And I don't think it has anything to do with that. Babylon is compared with an eagle swooping down on its prey and swooping down on Moab. And that's what it's talking about. John?
Do you recall the one where they get the airplane from?
I don't remember.
Is it out of Daniel?
Oh, yeah. Daniel chapter 12, where it says that knowledge shall increase and they shall run to and fro throughout the earth, or something like that. Some people understand that to mean something that could only happen since there were airplanes invented that we could travel through the whole world. But, people have tried to take these prophecies in isolation from their context and try to make them all last days prophecies. It's not legitimate. Well, chapter 49, I really don't want to go into detail on. It's, again, largely the same kind of stuff, against the Ammonites first, then against the Edomites. We read of in verse 12 of the Edomites drinking the cup of judgment. Again, a repeat from chapter 25. Do you have some questions about that?
About what was covered today so far. Oh, yeah, about the Edomites.
Yeah.
The prophecy about
Eden, it says that your widows too can trust. It says, leave your orphans, I will protect your lives. Which verse?
It's about, I don't know,
maybe
it's 15.
Just one of the Between 7 and 22 somewhere?
And that's about halfway.
Verse 11,
is it? Leave your fatherless children, yeah, and I will preserve them alive.
And let your widows trust in me.
Uh-huh.
But then when he just read Nahum's prophecy, he said, or not Obadiah, he said not one would survive.
Right. Obadiah is speaking, I think, of a later time. See, Edom wasn't finally destroyed by the Babylonians. I suppose that the destruction of Edom that's here talked about is, well, you're right, this is quoted in Obadiah. Obadiah quotes much from this chapter. But I don't know if he's applying it to the same time, because Jeremiah was, I think, talking about the Babylonians coming, but the ultimate destruction of the Edomites was later than this. They still existed for some time after the Babylonian captivity, but they were destroyed eventually by raiding bands of Sabians and others. So the wording, I'm glad you pointed out Obadiah, because the wording of this prophecy against Edom is very much like the prophecy of Obadiah, which is one chapter long against Edom also. And it seems clear that Obadiah either borrowed from Jeremiah or vice versa some of the thoughts. But I think if Obadiah was borrowing from Jeremiah, it may be that he was just picking up familiar language from Jeremiah about Edom and taking it to its ultimate fulfillment when the Edomites would be totally obliterated, totally extinct. It's hard to say because, you know, the Edomites didn't just go out with a bang at one time in history. They kind of got raided by a succession of raids, sort of like the Roman Empire didn't fall at just one time. It fell when the Huns came in and when others came in, and it was a period of time that it was falling, and the Edomites perished that way too. So the way I would see it is that Jeremiah is talking about one of these early raids, maybe by the Babylonians against Edom, and Obadiah is talking about the ultimate extinction of the Edomite race. Yeah.
But I've got another question about it doesn't seem doesn't make sense why Zedekiah and Jehoiakim, why they would give Jeremiah such a problem when in the first bunch of people who were deported,
uh-huh.
3,000, it was, and there was only 4,600 Jews deported in total, and so it's like two-thirds of the people were deported the very first time, and that the second deportation was only 830, and the last deportation only 745.
No,
only 745.
No, the second deportation, when Jehoiakim was taken, there were 10,000 taken with him. Are you reading it from Kings, or where are you getting the numbers?
Jeremiah 52.
That's the right verse. 27. Then the king of Babylon struck them and put them in Riblah. And Judah was carried away captive in their own land. Where do you get the number of them there?
832 people from Jerusalem. 18th year Nebuchadnezzar.
In verse 29, maybe? Yeah, that would be 832 persons. And then carry away 745 persons. Now, all the persons were 4,600. I think that that has to do with 586 B.C., just that last deportation. I'm not reading it maybe carefully enough. You have the impression that this is from all three of the deportations? Because the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar, I believe, was 586 B.C. He came in his first year in 605. 605 B.C. was his first year, according to Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. The 18th year would be about the time of the final destruction.
How about, it says in his 23rd year, 745 Jews.
That's the 23rd year.
It's in the 7th year, the 18th year, and the 23rd year.
Yeah.
The 18th year was 587 BC.
The 18th year was 587?
BC.
Okay, so the 23rd year must be perhaps when he came to Judah after Gedaliah was killed or something. Because it'd be later, it'd be 5 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. Yeah, I have to admit, and you can tell just by my response, I haven't really worked out all those dates here carefully. The fact of the matter is I wasn't planning to teach that chapter until tomorrow. But I just got the jump, we got the jump on it today because we had extra time at the end of this session. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I have to look into that. Yes, Stephen?
One thing. Why would Ishmael have been so stupid to bother stopping and after or questioning Jeremiah knowing that he was a prophet?
Why was Ishmael?
Yeah.
What passage are you referring to?
The Well, if Ruth going down to Egypt, Ishmael was in that group, weren't they?
No. Ishmael was the guy who killed Gedaliah. He escaped to the land of the Ammonites.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's the last we hear of him. It was. You might be thinking of.
I got.
Who are you thinking of?
Ishmael went to the land of the Ammonites with those 10 people. He took captives, right?
He took 8 people with him. He started making his way there with a lot of captives, but the Jews pursued him and stopped him, and he escaped with 8 people and went into the land of the Ammonites.
And who were these people that go to Egypt and stop and get Jeremiah?
They are the ones who rescued the captives from Ishmael. Okay. Yeah, it's Johanan. Yeah, Johanan, the son of Kareah, is the guy who was one of the main leaders of the group that pursued Ishmael and delivered the captives, and then was one of the leaders of those who went down to Egypt.
I think what Steve's asking is, why didn't Johanan and the crew, why were they hypocritical and not listening to Jeremiah?
Why didn't they listen to Jeremiah? Is that your question? Why did they ask him in the first place and didn't?
I guess my question would be then, if they did seemingly a good act to get back the people that Ishmael took, why are they going against Jeremiah's words, and why are they scared?
If they did a good thing by rescuing those captives from Ishmael, why are they not being good later by disobeying Jeremiah's words? If Josiah was a good king, why did he do a bad thing and go against the prophet who told him not to go against Pharaoh Necho? If Hezekiah was a good king, why did he do a bad thing by showing the Babylonians his treasures?
Feel that they were in danger from Nebuchadnezzar?
Yes, they did. They felt like the Babylonians were going to come and kill them.
But they weren't actually.
Jeremiah told them they wouldn't be in danger if they'd stay. Yeah, they just didn't believe it. But a lot of good people did bad things. Abraham lied about his wife. Wasn't good, but it's real life. Sometimes good people do bad things. People who are, let's just put it this way, people who do some good things also do some bad things. Whether we call them good people or bad people has to be judged on another basis, I guess. John?
Could have been also because they were proud men that were turning their hearts to the west, so maybe a combination of pride and fear.
Yeah, they were afraid. We know they were afraid of the Babylonians, they say so. And we're also told that they're proud. I think they may have reacted to Jeremiah calling them hypocrites. Anyway.
Also.
Yes?
It's kind of interesting. It's Jeremiah 31, when he, said, woe to those who go down to Egypt, was almost a fulfillment, it seemed like, of that. Mm. They're trusting in chariots and horsemen and men.
You mean Isaiah 31?
Yeah, it's a reflection that they've, rejected God as their king. And
in Isaiah 31, woe to those who go down to Egypt. Yeah. Actually, what Isaiah was saying is that in the days of Hezekiah, some were sending messengers down to Egypt to get soldiers to come and deliver them from Assyria. It was a slightly different setting. But yeah, going down to Egypt was always what the prophets told people not to do. Let me just make a comment on chapters 50 and 51, because these are a prophecy against Babylon. And the reason I want to say something about it is because, for one thing, a lot of the language here against Babylon is picked up again in Revelation chapter 17 and 18, when it's talking about the fall of spiritual Babylon, or mystery Babylon as it's called. And a lot of modern people have tried to take these prophecies against Babylon and try to find some modern connection to the modern nation of Iraq, to Baghdad, or to Saddam Hussein trying to rebuild the city of Babylon or something like that. And I just want to say, I don't see any justification whatsoever in these prophecies for that. Jeremiah predicts the fall of Babylon in chapters 50 and 51. Isaiah predicts the fall of Babylon in Isaiah 13 and 14. Babylon fell. It fell to the Medes and the Persians in ancient times, 536 B.C., and there's no reason to look for a fulfillment of these prophecies beyond that. There's nothing in these. The reason that some people try to look for further fulfillment is because they affix a more literal interpretation than the prophetic language really calls for.
And it sells books.
And it sells books in times like this, right. But, they no doubt feel like they are justified in reading into these a fulfillment in the last days, but it's totally a misunderstanding of the way the prophets use language. For instance, when the prophet says that Babylon will fall like, it'll be like when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. I heard a tape from someone who said, well, that didn't happen. God didn't send fire from heaven on Babylon yet. That'll have to happen in the last days, I guess, because he didn't overthrow them like he overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. But what he was saying is, he'll make an utter end of them, just as he made an utter end of Sodom and Gomorrah, not necessarily through the same means, that is, fire and brimstone from heaven. And to take the prophet's language and to impose a too literal interpretation on it is just not justified, and it leads people into all kinds of unwarranted applications and a failure to see that these prophecies were fulfilled before Jesus even came, a long time before Jesus came. And these laments over Babylon and the command to flee from the midst of Babylon, as I said, are picked up again in the book of Revelation, as where Mystery Babylon is doomed also, and many of the same words are used, borrowed from Jeremiah by John, the writer of Revelation. And when we say Revelation, we can no doubt call attention to some of those, but I feel that if we had more time, like if we didn't have to cover the minor prophets as we do in the time remaining this week, I would possibly try to deal more in detail with these burdens, but I know from experience that they tend to be repetitious and drawn out, and as you've seen, even the prophecies we've covered in Jeremiah already have had an awful lot of repetition, and that can be very wearing. If you've already read these chapters, if there's some things you don't understand about them, I'd be very glad to try to help you understand them, if I understand them. And at that, I think we should close our treatment of Jeremiah so that we can get tomorrow into the studies of the minor prophets. Chapter 52 is a historical epilogue. It covers much of the same information that were covered in chapters 39 through 44. And so we won't deal with that in detail either. Although, as Charmaine pointed out, there are some details there that I'm not sure how to work through. I think because we have only one reference to certain things, like the 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar, and it doesn't say much about what he did. It says, in the 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar, verse 30 of chapter 52, Nebuchadnezzar and the captain of the guard carried away captive of the Jews 745 persons. We don't know under what circumstances that was. The 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar is not mentioned anywhere else in the scriptures. All we know is that some more Jews, a few hundred more, were carried away at that time. What circumstances precipitated that? We don't know. It may have been, as I said, a result of the murder of Gedaliah, but it doesn't tell us that, and we don't have outside information in the Bible to tell us, so some of this is a little hard to be specific about. But what we find is that Jeremiah's prophecies were fulfilled. Jerusalem fell. He spent his final years in Egypt and apparently died there. He did not live long enough to see the return of the exiles from Babylon, however. But Daniel and Ezekiel both lived at that time. Daniel certainly lived to see the return of the exiles. I don't know whether Ezekiel did or not. All right, well, we're finished then. Yes, Vince.
When is Lamentations written during this same time?
Traditionally.